This is Rory Spiegel and Ryan Radecki, and this is the Annals of Emergency Medicine podcast. So we have unfortunately lost our professional introducer for the month due to an unfortunate cold, but we're hoping he'll be back shortly. But until then, you have Ryan and I for the June 2022 podcast. Ryan, how you doing?
I'm good. And we are rejoined by Rory's voice.
Yeah, it's getting there. I don't know if it'll be there by the end of the podcast, but it's slowly getting better.
98% back to peak performing condition.
Something like that. I don't know if I was ever at peak performing condition, but I'm as close as I will get there.
Excellent. All right. Well, let's do it.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. The first article from this issue that we're going to discuss is called Development of a Novel Emergency Department Quality Measure to Reduce Very Low-Risk Syncope Hospitalizations. Our lead author here is Mark Probst, and he's at the Columbia University Medical Center. And so, huzzah and bang the pots, it's time for another emergency department quality measure. But before we even talk about this quality measure, it ought to be abundantly clear. We have too many quality measures, and few quality measures survive their first encounter with the enemy intact. Too many measures can be gamed or result in unintended consequences, causing low-value care and adverse resource utilization. So, but then, now that I've cleared the air on my biases, this is a quality measure looking at syncope, one of the historically most low value of evaluations. We have already done a ton of work looking at syncope, and we've already got clinical policy statements in which there are basically only two vital things to do in the emergency department for a patient with syncope: an ECG and a thorough history and medical examination to consider underlying causes. That's it. No blood work, no CTs, nothing is mandated. And we even have complex risk scores like the Canadian Syncope Risk Score, which can give us an okay picture of the short-term morbidity of patients with syncope. Basically, everything in the ED ought to be reinforcing a culture in which syncope is infrequently a condition for which subsequent adverse outcomes require hospitalization. This article addresses that in two parts. There's a wee derivation in which the authors tried to come up with a simple, repeatable measure to determine a rough approximation of the number of inappropriate admissions for syncope. The result of their retrospective cohort analysis came up with the simple rule of age less than 50 years or history of heart disease. This resulted in a cohort of which 0.5% of the patients had a serious event at 30 days, most of whom were hospitalized for a non-arrhythmic condition, like a GI bleed or a pulmonary embolism. The second phase prospectively applied this rule as a rough, quote-unquote, quality measure and found massive variation across hospitals with respect to the number of patients in this bespoke, quote-unquote, low-risk cohort, including hospitals with admission rates of up to 20 to 50% for patients meeting this low-risk definition. So, success. Their measure has face validity, is simple to apply, and uncovers tremendous variation. The question, however, remains, what do we do with this without actually having adverse effects on clinical practice? It's easy to look backwards and clearly see many clinicians are on the wrong track. It's a lot harder to transform this insight into practice guidance, carrots and sticks, without unintended consequences. Just look at the 30-day Medicare readmission penalty for a cautionary tale, in which, rather than just improving inpatient care and discharge support, it also gave rise to this whole cottage industry of opposition to appropriate medical care and rehospitalization. So that anytime you evaluate a quality measure such as this, the most important thing to think about is the potential downstream unintended consequences.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think we learned from last month that the way to influence practice is shame and then threatening one's employment. And those are probably the biggest motivators we have. Now, as you said, I'm not sure we should move quickly to shame and threatening one's employment with this quality measure in and of itself. I don't think you're there yet. I do like its simplicity because, I think, most patients under 50 who syncopize and have a negative ED workup should go home. But I think that leaves you still with about 40% of the cohort that could still mostly probably all go home, but don't meet these criteria.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably a good picture of the almost certainly do not need to be admitted. So if any of these patients are being admitted, then roughly, yes, there's something going wrong in your hospital's culture. The problem is that once you turn it into an actual quality measure and you start measuring hospitals on it, it doesn't always translate into better medical care or high quality medical care. It just translates into metric-based care,
right.
and which sometimes causes people who require appropriate workups to miss out on them, or potentially just to change coding practices, have different admitting right. diagnoses to get around it. So that's the problem. These quality metrics are not surrogates necessarily for better care. They're just surrogates for metric-based care.
Right. Yeah, I would argue they almost never improve care. They just involve gaming the system, right? And that's usually what happens.
And another layer of administrative paperwork and another right. administrator sending you emails and so on and so forth.
Which I think we can all agree we need less of that. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, why don't we move on? I think the one last point there is you can say that you know, young people with syncope and a negative ED workup can likely go home.
Yes, we know that. Whether it should be a quality measure is another thing entirely. That's a whole operations thing.
Right. All right. Well, our next article is test characteristics of chest ultrasonography for rib fractures following blunt chest trauma, a systematic review and meta-analysis. The lead author is James Gilbertson. So, you know, the use of ultrasound as a diagnostic tool has grown in prevalence in the practice of emergency medicine. And these authors examined its utility to identify rib fractures. And so they conducted a systematic review and meta-analysis, identifying over 1,600 citations and eventually whittling this down to 6 studies in their final analysis. They defined rib fracture identification on ultrasound. Most commonly, this was defined as cortical discontinuity in 5 studies, though 2 of these studies also used other findings like hematoma formation or reverberation echoes. The finding of rib fracture on ultrasound had a pooled sensitivity of 89.3% and a pooled specificity of 98.4%, with the gold standard being a rib fracture confirmed on CT. They reported a pooled positive likelihood ratio of 55.7 and a negative likelihood ratio of 0.11. So just to remind listeners, a positive likelihood ratio over 10 usually shifts your pretest probability to somewhere where it's usable, and a negative likelihood ratio of less than 0.1 usually shifts your post-test probability of somewhere usable. So both these are fairly respectable. That being said, the editorial written by Daniel Wingrow makes a number of points that are worth discussing. First, the quality of these studies that were included in the meta-analysis was highly variable. For example, it's unclear the extent of training that all practitioners had before using ultrasound to identify rib fractures. It's also unclear how many of these studies were performed on awake patients, where they can tell you where it hurts when you're moving the probe across their chest, versus unconscious multi-trauma patients who cannot. In addition, there's a lack of children involved in this data, and that's the patient population you'd probably be most eager to use ultrasound on. In my mind, I think this is an interesting study. I think the data, you know, that they included is fairly weak to make any definitive statements, but usually ultrasound's fairly good at identifying stuff like this. And so you could probably use ultrasound to identify rib fractures. The question is, why would you? And what I mean by this, isolated rib fractures can mostly be diagnosed clinically in well-appearing people, and you can simply get an x-ray if you really want to prove the point, but they probably don't require anything further. In the complex patient who have risk of multiple rib fractures, and the real concern is the concomitant injuries that are involved in these high-speed, high-velocity injuries, and those kind of patients will require a CT because you want to identify further things than just the rib fractures themselves. And so it's a pretty niche population that you're going to have to get that, you know, can't get just by with a physical exam and need less than a CT scan.
Yeah, I mean, so that their conclusion is this is really powerful as a positive or a negative, you know, predictive tool. But then, like you talk about, the generalizability of the actual studies they've included is really poor. Only 16% of the patients included were women. So, I mean, we do have a fair number of people with trauma who are women, who need to be evaluated for rib fractures. And usually the ones who, you know, so is ultrasound a valid tool in, I don't know, half our population all of a sudden. Same thing with children a little bit, although I think most children, you don't really worry about rib fractures so much as the pulmonary contusions. And if they have enough energy, you're doing a CT anyways. Maybe it's not a population of interest to me specifically, because I feel like the children are mostly rubber except for their long bones, apparently,
right.
in my book.
But so, again, you're dealing with the concurrent injuries there that you care about more than the actual infection.
Yeah. Then I think my last favorite thing about this article is just the typesetting. When they did their little risk of bias table, they have little sad faces for when it's a high risk of bias and a little happy green face when it's a low risk of bias. Yeah. So if you want to see that beautiful typesetting, you can pop open the issue and take a look at that. But it gave me a little bit of a laugh while I was reading the article.
Yeah, it reminds me of those pain scores.
Very important. Yeah, that's like a paper quality pain score. Sad faces. All right. The next article from this issue we'll talk about is called "The Utility of a Novel Definition of Healthcare Regions in the United States in the Era of COVID-19: A Validation of the Pittsburgh Atlas Using Pneumonia Admissions." Lead author here is Michael Dalton, and they're at Harvard Medical School. I'd say this article is likely of greatest interest for those in health policy and budgetary positions, or those doing research regarding the delivery of healthcare at the macro level. One of the issues researchers and health policy analysts face is identifying, generally speaking, the catchment area for different healthcare regions, and thusly the resourcing required from, you know, a trauma standpoint, a hospital need standpoint, etc. And determining these healthcare delivery regions is kind of a unique challenge associated because of, for example, defining healthcare resourcing at a state level, while appealing from structural reasons, ignores the effects of these cross-border dependencies, such as regions such as metropolitan areas like Vancouver, Washington, and Portland, Oregon, or like the two Kansas cities, you know, one Kansas City, Kansas, and Kansas City, Missouri, which share so many healthcare resources and have overlap in their patient populations, but are divided by state boundaries, among many others. This analysis compares primarily the Pittsburgh Atlas against the Dartmouth Atlas, using the primary admitting diagnosis of COVID-19 or pneumonia to track sort of the locations of care for citizens in the United States and how they went to these different cities and regions. Grossly speaking, using their analysis of a subset of these regions, the Pittsburgh Atlas and the Dartmouth Atlas performed similarly. And the folks doing the analysis generally favored the Pittsburgh Atlas as they feel like it more frequently respects the state borders, which makes it easier for these budgetary considerations than the Dartmouth Atlas. So, again, primarily of interest to those tasked with measuring capacity and allocating resources across the United States, using this as a tool to capture where folks generally receive care. And it should also be noted this evaluation was based primarily off medical diagnoses, which is distinct from how the trauma system networks work, which may give very different results.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like you said, this is, you know, primary interest of the people who are doing health policy. You know, it's an interesting read in how you do this kind of research. But outside of that, it's hard to find a clinical application to something like this for the day-to-day clinician. All right, well, why don't we move on? Our next article is Emergency Department Visits During the Postpartum Period, a Canadian Cohort Study. And the lead author is Brittany Matinchuk. So this is an interesting article that's looking at a fairly specific question. The authors posed a hypothesis that in the postpartum period, where the patients are going through a transition in care from their obstetrician to their primary care physicians, they would experience more unplanned ED visits due to this gap in care. So they conducted a population-based retrospective analysis using the linked healthcare data from the province of Alberta. And they included all postpartum individuals residing in Alberta who had deliveries more than 20 weeks of gestation between April 2011 and March 2017. Using the National Ambulatory Care Reporting System, they then identified how many of these patients had ED visits during their postpartum period, which they defined as essentially a year after delivery. Now, they broke that up into the first 6 weeks, 6 weeks to 3 months, and then up to a year. But they included everyone up to an ED visit a year following the delivery. They identified a total of over 250,000 pregnancies from a total of over 190,000 individuals. The mean age at delivery was 30. The average gestational age ranged between 38.4 weeks and 38.8 weeks. During the study period, 44.7% of these postpartum periods resulted in one or more ED visits. This was about 70.8 visits per 100 pregnancies, so fairly high. 17.7% of the ED visits were obstetric in nature. Most of these, 82%, occurred in the immediate term. Most of the visits to the ED were discharged, 87.9%. And most of the complaints that they recorded seem to be related to the pregnancy of some sort. The authors identified some factors that predicted an increased risk of an ED visit during the postpartum period. This was younger maternal age, living in rural or remote areas, having an increased maternal or social deprivation scores, multiparity, need for intensive prenatal care. Furthermore, patients with chronic illnesses or mental health problems or cancer were also at increased risk of presenting to the emergency department. So, you know, I think this is interesting. I think a lot of this can be expected. I think it offers a healthcare system that has the resources and the information to identify patients that are higher risk and maybe give them more access to care in the prenatal period, the opportunity to do so to try to maybe avoid some of these visits. You know, somewhere like Canada, I think, has the resources to do that. In America, I think we're far from, you know, even having the capacity to identify these patients, far from setting up the resources to help them like this.
Yeah, I mean, certainly this is of interest for a system that's trying to improve its healthcare system and has the motivations and resource, you know, sort of limitations in which they have to provide as much possible care from the smallest bucket of money necessarily. And they're trying to ensure that the patients who are, you know, this is an interesting subgroup of patients in the immediate postpartum period with a certain level of resource utilization. And maybe there are ways, now that we've identified this as a problem, to head off some of these issues. It should be noted these are not all obstetric visits in the postpartum period. You know, only about 15 odd percent of the visits that were to the emergency department after the postpartum period were actually related to obstetrics, and the rest were non-obstetric visits. So it's a little bit hard to parse out exactly what's going on with that specific issue, certainly a window for further research to provide more insight into the opportunity to intervene on these patients in the postpartum period to ensure that they get the proper follow-up and either get their problems avoided or how they're resourced to emergency departments so that they can support this patient population.
Yeah, and you know, there is no like a control group or comparison group here. We don't know, you know, what's the rate of presentation in the same type of patient with the same age and comorbidities, just not in the postpartum period, right?
The propensity match score of some sort.
Right. And to be fair, this does seem fairly high, right? Like 71 visits per 100 postnatal periods does seem like a fairly high rate. But when you think about it, you know, this is a year-long period that they're counting as the postpartum period. So it's not surprising that it's specifically after that, you know, the immediate period that a lot of these visits are just presenting to the emergency department as anyone else would.
Mm-hmm. And most people went home. So right. About 90% of people with non-OB visits went home, and about 80% of people with non-OB visits went home. So, you know, most people do not stick around you know, with serious problems, but there's obviously something that needs to be evaluated or reassured upon. I don't know.
Yeah.
If I had to guess, it's probably a lot of mastitis. I feel like that's probably the primary primary thing I see postpartum.
Yeah. They don't, unfortunately, they went in mostly into the complaints of the obstetric-related complaints, but they didn't really get into what were the leading causes of the non-obstetric complaints, as far as I could see.
A future publication, we hope.
Yeah.
All right. And the last article we're going to talk about from this issue is called Identifying Social Media Competencies for Health Professionals, an International Modified Delphi Study to Determine Consensus for Curricular Design. Our lead author here is Yusuf Yılmaz, and they're at the Ege University in Izmir, Turkey. And here we are on a form of social media and talking about what sort of considerations professionals should have when interacting with or on social media. It's kind of like that podcast bit we did on whether anybody remembers whether they heard anything on a podcast if it was listened to while driving a car. But this article looks at effectively a survey and a consensus document produced by an international group looking at the sorts of skills health professionals should have regarding social media. They surveyed over 90 health professionals with some presence and expertise in social media and iteratively derived a list of domain-specific knowledge and skills, trimming a longer list down to a shorter list while then also adding additional elements and finally settling on a list of 48 items, of which 80% of surveyed experts agreed may be important. These items effectively fell into a few categories: general knowledge regarding applications of social media, platforms upon which to interact with social media, skills, competencies, and attitudes, including professionalism. As with any sort of expert consensus, the ultimate items reflect the biases of the groups surveyed, as well as the transient unique applications of current platforms. But the list of endorsed expectations for skills is fairly reasonable. It includes things such as, you know, the purpose of being on social media, for example, to interact with new literature and communicate with colleagues, highlights the Twitter and blog and podcast platforms, as well as the competencies necessary to produce and interact with such content professionally. The idea behind this list, if a module were to incorporate it into medical education, the endorsed skills here could form the basis of the curriculum, and I feel like this is a fairly reasonable effort to look at if you are somebody who is designing such a curriculum.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, it's funny, both you and I grew up in like the Wild West of the social media era, right, where we created our blogs and started everything before there were any rules and regulations. And so I think we have a different perspective on it. But I do think at some point, someone's going to have to create a curriculum. You know, when we started, it was really just getting people to take it as a serious form of education. You know, there was the questions were, is blogs, are podcasts actually ways for learners to learn? I think we've moved past that and trying to figure out how to incorporate it into an education program. And I think this is a reasonable way to start.
Well, it wasn't so long ago. I feel like we were at ASAP with, you know, Nick Jeans and Jeremy Fausta, and they were like, we'd have sessions about like, should you be on Twitter? You know, yeah. What's a podcast? These sorts of things. And now it's like, you know, now everybody's like, Joe Rogan has a podcast, and like literally like the Surgeon General's on Twitter. You know, it's like everybody's on Twitter. Now it's about how do you actually maintain a presence and use the presence. And, you know, to some extent, asking a bunch of, you know, 40 plus year olds how to be on social media is kind of like, hey, cool kids, what's hanging? You know, like we should probably be asking, you know, some of the 20 and, you know, 50, the younger generation about like what they're concerned about on social media as well. Sure. So by this sort of self-appointed list of experts, you know, like any sort of convenient sample of experts will have its own biases and, you know, experiences. But certainly there's a whole section of the population which spends a ton of time on social media that probably has some different ideas about, you know, privacy, you know, and appropriateness and things like that.
Yeah, no, exactly. But I think, you know, that goes with all education. We're always going to be, you know, the people that make the rules and guidance of education are never the ones on the cutting edge of the education, just given who's doing the learning and who's doing the teaching.
Yeah, I mean, look at this. We're not even on TikTok, you and I. And by the time we got around to being on TikTok, there'd be something new.
Yes, exactly.
So, yeah. But I don't know if you want to see us on TikTok.
No. We're best on podcasts and blogs, I think.
All right. That was the June issue.
I think that wraps us up.
There's more, obviously, than what we talk about in every issue. We just cover some of the highlights that you can glean while you are, as it were, driving in your car or running or exercising. Sitting peacefully by a beach.
Encourage you to go not only look at the happy faces and smile and frowny faces, but read the rest of the article as well, because there's some really great stuff. But until next month, any comments, questions, or concerns, we can reach at annalsaudio@asep.org. Otherwise, this is Rory Spiegel and Ryan Radecki, and this was the Annals of Emergency Medicine Podcast.